Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 26 of the Power Up Real Estate Podcast. I am so excited. This episode is a fun episode because it marks 6 months of bringing content via the Power Up Real Estate Podcast and the amazing people we've been able to interview and the amount of people we've been able to help. And so thankful to you for tuning in. And as always, it means so much to us when you subscribe to the channel. So if you wouldn't mind doing us a favor, subscribing to the channel, leaving us a review, we love, love, love to hear from our family. And that helps us in with iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify and all the places our podcast is hosted, because it helps us get up in the algorithm and help more people so more people can find the podcast easily. But as you know, we have one goal on this podcast: to help 10,000 people create financial freedom by investing in real estate. So many people are either tied to a job they don't enjoy or have a life they don't want or want to travel more. And we see real estate is one of the ways to get there. And that's why we are so passionate about this. Also, just a quick tip of the day, remember to follow us as well on YouTube. I post videos, 2 videos a week, ranging from how to raise capital to how to find deals, to operations, etc. You just go to YouTube, type in my name, and we'll come up there. We want to continue to grow our family on YouTube as well. So make sure you check that out for videos that will I'll often walk through deals I'm doing, etc. So hope to see you over there as well. And one of the things that I was thinking about in the last few weeks here as we're coming into Thanksgiving, and this is the end of 2020. For many people, it's been a really, really hard year, and this year can creates a lot of different emotions for people. And I hope this year you are finding ways to control your thinking and control your environment rather than letting things you can't control control your joy, happiness, and your productivity. And this year, it's been really, really important to keep our mind focused on what we really want, the goals we want to accomplish, how we want to give back, how do we want to continue to spread our mission. And that's important. And if you are still in that kind of that limbo mode of thinking, how do I really get my first deal? Or I've got a deal, it was a 2 or a 4 unit or even a 10 unit, and I really want to scale up and I really want to make this work. Don't wait. Let us help you. We've done this. We can cut the learning curve down. We have a lot of students that are knocking down deals right now. Please just, if you go to 10weekmulti.com, we have a 10-week academy that we can help people get pieces of real estate in 10 weeks or less. And we specifically focus on how to knock down multifamily cash producing pieces of real estate. So if you go to 10weekmulti.com, that's 10weekmulti.com, I'll put that in the show notes. You can watch a short little training, and then if it resonates with you, you can book a call with me or my team. We'll hop on the phone and see if you're a good fit. But we really, really have a mission to help 10,000 people create financial freedom through real estate. And it's hard to just do that through podcasting or on our YouTube channel. We want to offer some one-on-one support for people that really, really want to level up their game and get going quickly. So that is there. We really, really would love to hop on the phone with you and talk through your goals, see where you want to go and how we can be of assistance to get you there. But I am so pumped for our show today for a couple reasons. One of the things that is not as sexy in the multifamily game is learning how to underwrite a property well. And what that means is when you are looking at a property, should you buy that property or should you not buy that property, is all told by the numbers. We always say this, the numbers, people can lie about numbers, but numbers never lie. The underwriting process is seeing how much your expenses, what's your income, and what's your cash on cash return going to be. And there's a lot of different things that go into that process. If you don't know how to underwrite a property well, you'll find yourself with a property you wish you didn't have, or you'll pass on a property that maybe you should have capitalized on. And today I interview a friend of mine, Suja Sham, who is not only an underwriter by training and trade, she did her very first deal in graduate school by leveraging student loans. Yes, you heard that right. She found a way to leverage student loan money and buy her first piece of real estate. She is one of the smartest young investors I've ever had the privilege of interviewing. She's an amazing, amazing person, really wants to help people. And she's the founder of Lux Capital. And today I talked to her a little bit about underwriting. How do you underwrite a property well, making sure you don't miss expenses, make sure you don't underwrite incorrectly, and expect returns that you never realize. And so today I am so, I have such a pleasure to interview Suja, and she is going to bring not only her background in underwriting, but just a few tips and tricks that you can apply the next time you get a deal and you start to see if that's a good property. All that and more today on the Power Up Real Estate Podcast.
One man, one mission, to help people create freedom through real estate. Welcome to the Power Up Real Estate Podcast that brings you pure gold when it comes to investing in real estate, growing your net worth, and create the life you want. It's time to find deals and find money. Please welcome your host, Mike Fritz.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Power Up Real Estate Podcast. I'm Mike Fritz. I'm your host. And today we get to interview somebody that I met probably about 6-7 months ago. And another multifamily real estate investor, but she brings an interesting skill set to the game, not only by trade, but also by practicality in what she does for a lot of the teams she works with. And that is in the underwriting process. If you don't know what the underwriting process is or what that looks like or what's entailed in that, you're gonna today. So I just wanna welcome Suja to this show. Thank you so much, Suja, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's really great to be here.
Well, we met through a mutual friend of ours, another real estate investor, Vinny Chopra, who's been on our show, and who's a great investor. We've both seen some of the work he's done. You've been a part of some of his projects. But tell me a little bit about, how did you get into this real estate game? You're doing a lot of different kinds of investing, but how'd you get into this specific game of real estate? What drew you here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the very first property that I purchased when I was in graduate school, and I actually purchased it with my student loans because I didn't have any savings as a poor grad student. So it was a single family home. I purchased it with a friend. We purchased it for $20,000 and renovated it with our own sweat equity over the summer. And that was my very first foray into real estate. And after that, I became an underwriter of multifamily properties. And I then, you know, I always had this entrepreneurial spirit that was just not being fulfilled working for large institutions and making large deals happen. I really wanted to be driving my own ship. And that was apparent ever since I got out of business school. So I eventually slowly built up my own portfolio of short-term rentals, kind of happened by accident. It happened after I started to purchase my first house and I was house hacking, and I didn't know what house hacking was at the time, but I had roommates and, you know, my house was positive cash flowing. And then I ended up becoming a short-term rental host kind of by accident, but it was such good, consistent income. I built that up slowly. And at that point, I was also looking into syndications because I knew that I wanted to diversify out of hospitality. And I knew that syndications was the next step. I mean, I had been working in syndications just on the institutional side for several years, and the private equity world of syndications was new to me, but I knew that was kind of the next step for me as a real estate investor.
That's great. So how did you get connected? So you're in grad school. This fascinates me, how you leverage your student loans. I want to dig into that for just a minute before we move on. How in the world do you leverage a student loan to acquire real estate?
Certainly. So when you go to graduate school, you can get loans for your tuition, but you can also get loans for your living expenses. And I actually went to a presentation by a woman who founded Kiva.org, and which is a nonprofit that funds microfinance, microloans all over the world. And she was telling the story about how she got started. And she said that she started Kiva, like building out the website and whatnot, with her student loans. And she encouraged all of us in the room to use our student loans to fund our first business. And I just took that and ran with it. I was like, I'm going to do something with this money that I have.
That is amazing. I love that. Well, no, I love the creativity of that, right? Because most people, we go to school and loans are never seen as something that can leverage. It's all liability. It's never asset, right? And you took it and switched that completely around. I have to say, this is a first for the show. I've never talked to a real estate investor that's leveraged their student loans to build real estate. So you are not only the first, but that's fascinating. And that's really cool. So that first house you invested in, you fixed it up yourself. Did you keep that as a rental or did you flip that?
Yeah. So I think the keys to that deal were I had a partner. So my friend, John, and I, we went in on it together, and we were able to find something by driving with dollars or driving for dollars. We just drove, we picked a neighborhood and we just literally drove the streets on a very snowy, cold February day. And we hadn't really found anything, but the last house we found had a for sale by owner sign. And we were just like, oh, that doesn't look like a total piece of crap. Like it doesn't look like it's burned out. And, you know, it looks like maybe we could do something with that. We called the number. And so it was just, we got lucky, but also we did the work, you know? And so it was only $20,000. That's all he wanted for it, for a 2-bedroom house, 2 miles from downtown. So
wow,
it worked. Actually, we didn't have to get a mortgage. We just had to put $10,000 into it each. And then we kept it. We rented it to friends. We had thought we might flip it, but our friends wanted to move into it. So we just ended up renting to our friends basically for 5 years. And then, you know, things changed and it was time for us to kind of exit that property. So we sold it at that, like 5 years later for 5 times what we purchased it for.
Wow. What an investment. That's amazing. And so now, you've got your first deal. I mean, you're obviously, you're in grad school. You have your first deal. How do you make it from grad school to the multifamily game? How do you get there? What did that journey look like to slide into the multifamily game?
Yeah, well, it was longer and windier than I might have expected. I think I had two major options leaving grad school. One, I go work for a company, or two, I continue working with my friend John, and we just continue like flipping houses and making it happen kind of, you know, house by house. And I chose to go the job route. I took a job in multifamily. I knew I liked real estate. Someone had said underwriting is might be a good place for me to be. So I took an underwriting job, and it was a long and windy road to get back to being, you know, driving the ship, because you get the golden handcuffs, you have a career. It's just a little bit difficult to say goodbye to those things. It would have been easier, I think, if I had just kept on flipping houses.
Right.
But you know, now I have the underwriting skill set, and there are other things about it that were great. But so, I mean, essentially I started working, and you know, there was just something inside me that was just dead working for these institutions. Like I just did, it just was never going to work out. And I knew that. And so I had to figure out a way to get out of it. And just slowly, piece by piece, you know, first I started house hacking before I knew what house hacking was. And then I was like, I need to build a business. And I just started listening to the podcast and getting hooked in. And it wasn't until I really started just meeting people, like making calls to people on podcasts. And then, you know, I signed up for a group or two and just meeting people, even though I had all these skill sets and stuff, like you really need that synergy of working with other people to make things happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you start working for this company, and what does the day-to-day look like for you? So like you're in this company, what kind of things are you doing inside this company that connects you to multifamily? So it's a company, do they own multifamily? Do they manage multifamily? What was the company's primary objective?
Sure. So they were syndicators, and so they were institutional equity investors. And so they were creating funds, but the investors in those funds were like US Bank and Wells Fargo and this pension fund and that life insurance. And so like people, these were like, you know, $15 to $20 million funds or more. And then we would fill those funds with different properties, maybe like could be like $50 million funds. And we would just fill those funds with different properties. So what I was doing when I first started, I was basically writing the underwriting summary. So we would, you know, enter in the operating expenses to our model, and we would make sure that the model was functioning properly. And then I would write up, you know, these 80-page documents basically that went through the sponsor, the market, the deal, the title, environmental, just, it was just one after another, just like, and it would take a long time. Like, you know, I would spend like 3 to 8 months on a deal. And then I maybe have like 6 or 7 at a time. But it was very long process because it was low income housing tax credits. So it's very complicated. If it was just market rate, you know, if I was just working in market rate, the deals would be like 2 months each.
Yeah. Tell the difference for our listeners, a little bit of tax credit versus market rate, what that means.
Yeah. So I was specifically working for a company that invested in low income housing tax credits, which is a program by the federal government has to incentivize private developers for building affordable housing, because before, in like the 70s, the federal government was funding federal housing and they were building it themselves and managing it themselves, and it wasn't working. And so this was kind of a way to bring sort of free market capitalism into affordable housing, was like, we'll make incentivize private developers to build affordable housing, and maybe that'll get us a better result than what we had in the 70s. And sure, it's been extremely successful.
Yeah, yeah, it has. And it leverages the entrepreneurs that do this every single day and know this game, and then partners them with programs that can bring the housing, which is fantastic. So now let's transition. This is, you know, your story's fascinating. Number one, that you started leveraging student loans. I mean, one of the things we see in real estate is leverage is where we win, right? In every piece, whether you're leveraging bank money, investor money, or student loan money, which is a whole new ballgame. But the key, we talk about that all the students in our my coaching programs and everything, always as they start to invest in real estate, one of the biggest skills I have to help them see is how to actually evaluate a deal from start to finish to see if it's a worthy deal to acquire. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call this underwriting process. So what do you think, as your history as an underwriter, talk to me through the couple skill sets you need to hone. Let's start general, then we'll kind of dive into to some specifics. That general, what are some skill sets that are really important to hone and to develop to become the kind of underwriter that can foresee a successful project?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think when you're first learning underwriting, the most natural and easiest place to start is looking at the operating expenses and income. So if you're just looking at the NOI that a property is producing, and just, you know, first, like just figuring out, okay, this is what the operating expenses are, this is what the utilities are, this is what the property taxes are, this is what the income is. And there's a lot in that. Like, you have to know how to analyze, like, what's the rent growth that is being projected, and is that reasonable? You know, so that's like a whole piece that you can dive into and that you should dive into very closely. And then looking at the operating expenses and being like, okay, so am I going to keep the same property manager? Am I going to be trying to, just understanding how it's operating, am I going to try to decrease the operating expenses? And it's easier just to start with like a ratio, like 50%. But at some point, you're going to have to figure out whether you're planning on decreasing the operating ratio and by how much. And so I would say that's like the easiest and most natural place to start when you're first learning underwrite. The other thing I would recommend, it's kind of detailed, but if you have the patience for it, it's a valuable resource. Syndication School, Joe Ferrell's Syndication School, they have a very detailed several podcasts going through the underwriting process. It's pretty dry, but if you can force yourself to go through everything that they have, they really do a good job of breaking it down for beginners. And they'll say, this is what contract expenses should approximately be, and this is what, you know, and that's kind of very helpful to have those guidelines. It's like, well, I never go below, you know, $150 per door for R&M or something like that. So I would say that's the first place to start.
So, okay, good. So we kind of have this, I'm underwriting the project. The goal is to see, and you said a lot of things in there that I want to unpack. The first thing is you talk about rent growth, because we understand as we get the NOI, the only way that we see the forced appreciation on that backside is either increase income, decrease expenses, right? It's a really simple formula, but what gets us there is very, very meticulous, right? And so we all know that, okay, yeah, increase income, decrease expenses takes about 3 seconds to say. It can take anywhere from 3 to 10 years to realize, right? And so talk a little bit about, you mentioned rent growth. And this is one of the things I see a lot of new underwriters do. They put down, well, the two bedrooms are currently getting $950, but I know that we can get $1,050. But they don't go and verify that $1,050 projection, right? And that is a huge, if you're projecting you can jump up $200, you better justify that, because if you have a big property, 100 to 300, 400 units, you're talking about a lot of money. And if you misproject that, and really only, it only really separate, or you really only can go up to maybe 1,000 or 975 or whatever, mm-hmm. That's a big difference. So how do you verify rent growth? Like you say, you know, talk that well, a little bit, yeah, because that's one of our big things with when we see income expenses go for or income increase.
Yeah, I would say if you got, first of all, it really helps to know the market that you're working in. So if you have chosen a market to work in, then you should know, I mean, you know, you might not know at first, but like you should be working to a point where you can look at a unit and you know what it'll go for. And the way you get to that point is by talking to property managers, going and looking at units or doing virtuals at this point and understanding, well, okay, this is what rents are going for. And you can, you know, you can do preliminary research on like apartments.com or something just to see, you know, what people are advertising for.
Sure.
And that's like a good place to start if you really have no idea what's going to happen in the market. But I like property managers are really the best resource. Like they're the ones who are going to know how to push rents if they're a good property manager. And ideally in a property, you know, you may have a couple units that have been renovated and you may, if you have a good property manager, then you may have an idea of like what those units are going to go for. Of course, they might be able to be pushed, but you can't rely on that, right? So it's a tough game, you know, because you want to be able to be competitive when you're putting in offers, but you also, you know, want to make sure that you're going to be able to operate the property and create the kind of returns that you're hoping for. So I think one thing is like just buying in a market that is primed for growth is always super important. When we were underwriting LIHTC deals, we would have 2% income growth, no more than 2% ever. Of course, you know, if you were going to renovate your property. So if you take like what is the rent going to be once you renovate it and then increase it at 2%, I think that's pretty conservative. We would always increase expenses at 3%. So then you got to figure out other ways to create value, like creating more efficient operations, et cetera. But anyway, so back to rent growth though. So I would say it's not like you can just snap your fingers and automatically know what is going to be a reasonable projection. Like it's an art and it's a science. So I would definitely start with doing some preliminary research online, talking to property managers and focusing on a market so that you know what the people in those markets are going to be willing to pay for certain sure. amenities. And then that changes with time, right? So you have to be willing to evolve it over time.
And what, and when you say, when you talk about those markets, tell me the things that, cause we obviously, we, you know, some of those markets that are seeing those rent growth have higher competition, right? Growth. We always say kind of growth is the ceiling of competition, right? It raises the ceiling of competition raises with its ability to scale in its income. And so talk to me a little bit about what are your market or when you were working with your company, or even now you as a personal investor, what are you looking for in a market? Why go to one market over another in the multifamily game? Like, yeah, what are the things that you look for?
Primarily, it's about jobs and population growth. So if you want to find a place where you know there's going to be job growth and you know the population, it's just how to look at the trends. It's almost as simple as that. On top of that, you want to be in a city that's investing in, you know, the path of progress. So you want to be looking at like sort of that more granular level, like, well, like for example, in Portland where I live, there's certain neighborhoods that appreciated a ton between 2012 and 2017. And then after that, those markets started appreciating more slowly and the outlying areas started appreciating faster. So it's, you got to really have a handle on, of course, that's more in the single family area, but like, for example, that's also driving rent growth. So, understanding this more neighborhood specific dynamics of the market that you're in is also really important.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we've always said there's three things we look at: jobs and population growth. A lot of people confuse those two. They think, aren't they the same? They're not necessarily the same, because sometimes you might be in retirement markets where you have population growth, but there may not be as much job spikes, right? Because you know, you may look in some sectors that you see, wow, it's really growing, but we don't see a lot more jobs coming here. So we always say follow jobs, population growth, job growth. And another thing a lot of people look for is, you know, states that are landlord friendly, states that are, it's good, it's easy to operate a unit in those states. You know, some areas of the country are harder just because it's hard, if a tenant does go into delinquency, it's harder to assist them or move them out or whatever, because, and you could be stuck with a tenant for a long time without any income, you know, and that can really hurt. You talk about something that'll hurt your net operating income, for sure. But those three things for sure. And I think that's really, really valuable for our people to know, because markets, a lot of times when I first started investing, and I don't know if you were this way, but when I first started investing, I looked where I lived. And looking back on it now, I'm not sure that was the best model to invest in, right? What's your thoughts on that? Investing where you live or going towards those hot markets when you're starting out? What do you think?
Yeah, when you're starting out, so it's kind of a, I think both are important. So I live in Portland. Portland's like notoriously not a landlord-friendly city. Mm-hmm. And all cities are not necessarily, well, not all cities, but yeah, so Portland is not necessarily a place that I would want to buy multifamily. I do think if you're starting out and you're starting out with single family, that, you know, there are still opportunities there. Sure. To
definitely.
Although, you know, there's a lot of competition as well. So, but so yeah, so when it came to multifamily, I just decided that I was going to be not having, I was not going to be able to invest in Portland. Not at first anyways. I definitely have mentors and people that want me to work more locally and, you know, give back to the local market. But personally, I feel like that requires deeper pockets and something that I can do when I'm more established. I might be willing to kind of just operate with thinner margins or do something a little bit riskier. You know, I mean, I did buy a piece of real estate in Portland. I bought a fourplex in 2018, which was like, you know, the market was really hot back then. But my approach with that was my value add wasn't a multifamily play. It was a hotel play. So I bought it with, it had the underlying zoning to convert it to a hotel. And that was going to be my value add. And so that was something I was willing to do locally because it wasn't just your traditional multifamily. And you're not subject to the same laws that you are with long-term tenants.
Yeah. And we talk about sometimes the highest and best use of a building, right? And sometimes the highest and best use of a building could be not what you buy it for. It could not be multifamily. I mean, we're looking right now, one of the things I see coming down the pike is I see with, because we're filming this in the middle of COVID-19, we're in the end of 2020 here, and we're seeing, I think one of the things that's going to come with the highest and best use transition is we're going to see office buildings transformed into apartment buildings or transformed into industrial or transformed into something else, because with so many people going to virtual and businesses realizing they can leverage that and still maintain productivity, I think we're going to see a highest and best use switch in the next 4 to 5 years. You know, and that's just my crystal ball that is probably worth what you paid for it. But anyway, yeah, no, I think that's really important though, when you think about your market or you think, look at a building. So you look at that 4 unit, some people might've looked at the margins and say, no, thanks. You looked at it and say, you know what? There's another play here. That takes a little bit of seasoning as an investor to see that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, I already had 3 short-term rental units. And so I just knew how much I liked the business. And I was looking for a building with the underlying zoning that I could convert to a hotel, you know, hotel use. And so I was, you know, I went into it actually looking specifically for that, not just saying, oh, this is a nice building, what could I do with it? You know? So I think that also helps when you're looking for properties, is being really specific in what it is that the value you want to add to a property is.
Definitely. That's so true. So true. So we come back a little bit to this process. So when we start, people find the property, they're digging through the expenses, they're looking at rents, they're looking at taxes, insurance and expenses and R&M, which is repair and maintenance, or whatever the line items they're looking at. Tell me, over the years, what are some mistakes you see underwriters making that causes people to not realize the numbers they're projecting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I find that sometimes people don't put in, they'll just take the operating expenses that they were given and then just use those going forward instead of adjusting them to, you know, what is maybe going to be more realistic. So I've seen people leave out turnover expenses, for example. I've seen people leave out R&M, frankly.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, those are kind of big ones that maybe, you know, because they're just looking at like the operating percentage. They're saying, well, it was operating at 40%. So we could probably operate it at, you know, 37%, you know, just like looking at it very from a 10K, 10K view. So that's not how I would underwrite it personally, because of my training. And that's a good and bad thing, you know, because I tend to be very, very rigorous and conservative, and I need to also be able to zoom out and say, okay, well, I'm going to know exactly what I'm getting into, and I can take a step back so that we can still be competitive. But anyway, so what other mistakes have I seen people make? I think that's the biggest thing, is I have seen people not go through line item by line item and just adjust it to make sure that it's really something that if they think the whole project through that they're going to be able to achieve.
Sure. Sure. No, that's really good. And I think that's, we call that, we want to underwrite like a pessimist. And a lot of people underwrite like an optimist. And the problem with underwriting like an optimist is you can foresee things or hope for things that don't actually happen. But I have seen, I will agree with you, what you just said is, I think teams that have somebody that's really rigorous and somebody that can step out and see that vision, or if one person can do the you know, the telescoping thing and zoom in and out, good for them. Usually those skill sets operate in different people, but it's great to have a person on the team that can see the 20,000 foot view, but somebody that also can go down in and look at every single leaf to make sure that it's to make sure that you're not finding line items. You know, for example, one of the things that I see a lot of new underwriters do is they take the taxes and they don't think about the tax spike when they buy. Right? If a changeover of ownership, you often, not always, but often, depending on how long they've owned that asset, you could see a tax spike. Well, if they take a, you know, $10,000 a year on a smaller building tax number and it spikes to 15, that's a big jump percentage wise or whatever. If they've owned it for 20 or 30 years, you know, we're looking at an asset right now where the person's owned it for 30 years. Well, that we have to adjust for that, cause that's a big tax spike, you know,
100%.
And that's one of the things I see a lot too, that newer underwriters, this is why this is such a valuable podcast, because I think I want people to go into this with pessimism, not to look at every deal, you know, that way. And I'm not saying to go be a pessimistic investor, but also I've learned that that's cost me a lot more deals over the years, writing, underwriting that way. But I think it's made my investors trust me more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. It's a dance, you know, it's a,
exactly.
And that's one reason why it's helpful to focus in those growing markets, right? Because that allows you to be rigorous with your underwriting expenses and still feel that like, okay, well, I'm going to be able to force appreciation. And they'll be basically, if you underwrite conservatively and you're in a growing market, then there's going to be wiggle room. You know, you have more room to actually, for things to not go quite as planned if you're in a growing market, period.
Yeah. Well, and in a growing market, one of the things we often is icing, but really is cake. At the end of a deal is we see those growing markets where we may be able to compress the cap rate and we see some real spikes in appreciation at the end of a deal. And, you know, if you're buying in a extended tertiary market where you get outside the cities enough to where it's not really a tertiary market, you're not able to find that cap rate compression. And, you know, and you're kind of buying and selling at the same cap rate and relying all on your forced appreciation. And so those markets really, really help you underwrite. You're 100% right. It kind of gives you a little, I found that those bigger markets, while they're more competitive, they are a little bit more forgiving because there's more ways to generate revenue. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. You can have more amenities that you have people pay for. But you bring up a good point about the cap rate. So exit cap rate is a big one. I mean, that can change the projections of your deal drastically. And it's important.
Yes, it can.
Yeah. And, you know, you know, with like moving by 50 basis points or 25 basis points, you can see huge swings in your projections. It's really important to, you know, have a conservative cap rate. So to expand that cap rate over the course of the deal, like you just have to expand it. And then how much you expand it, that's like, you know, that's a little bit more of a gray area for sure. But yeah, it's really easy to paint a rosy picture of the deal if you compress the cap rate in your projections.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, I always underwrite exiting at the same cap rate I enter in, and then allowing that compression to kind of feel like just surprise all my investors when they get when we can exit or refinance at a much better cap rate. You know what I mean? Because I think, you know, you come into a 6.5 or a 6, and you want to, and you plan on exiting at a 5.5, and you're not able to come down that low, then you miss it by a, and 5.5 and 6 doesn't sound like a lot in cap rate. When you're exiting, that can be millions.
Mm-hmm, and definitely.
So that could be a lot of money. And so, you know, so that's, I completely agree with you. And I think that the mistakes you mentioned are so critical for people to understand, of going line item by line item. I like the theirs and ours numbers. Like when you take all those numbers, and I saw you do this with the deal that you acquired in Seattle, and you were sharing with our group, is you have the numbers you were given, but then here's the numbers that I think it's going to be. Talk about those numbers. Why don't you just take the numbers that they give you and apply them? Why do you have different numbers than the numbers that are given you by the sellers?
Sure. Well, you know, unless you can really look under the hood, you don't necessarily know how the property is operating. You kind of have to assume that you're going to go in there, and obviously, like, it's there, it's operating, but you're going to have to just basically start from, you want to treat it like you're operating a brand new property, that you're not just going to be doing things the way that they were being done, because the reason you're buying the property is so that you can do things differently, so that you can increase that NOI.
Yeah.
And so,
sure.
And also, like, you know, sometimes, depending on if it's a mom and pop owner, they might, you know, their books might not be totally 100% accurate or reflective. Maybe they weren't really doing a lot of work when they were turning over a property, turning over a unit, but maybe you need to put that expense in because you want to be able to bump the rents. And so you got to have a turnover budget. I think that also, like, if you're going to be switching up property managers or keeping the property manager, is that's always a big question. So if you have a property manager that you're going to work with, like, they might have slightly different procedures and fees, and it's important to really be in very close communication with your property manager and have a good picture of how they want to operate the property when you come in. And you know, you just want to go in with eyes wide open. And in order to do that, you have to really think through, okay, well, how is this part going to work? Like, you know, how about this? And how do I want it? What's my value play? Like, how are we actually going to increase that NOI?
Yeah, and on your turnover, do you bury that in your lost lease, or do you separate those line items out?
I don't bury that in the loss to lease. It's a separate line item.
Yeah. That's what I've seen those before, and I've had to actually dig into that. This is why everybody underwrites a little bit differently. And I've learned loss to lease, whether they're talking about what it's going to cost them to put a unit, or what it's going to cost them to turn it over, or what it's simply sometimes loss to lease. I've seen people even bury things like the rent differentials in there. You know what, we're leasing at 800, we could be leasing at 900, and that's a loss, quote unquote, to lease in the way that we're, and so everybody's, and this is why underwriting and using some sort of tool to underwrite. And all of you can email us at mike@powerprealestate.com, and you can get our deal analyzer to work through some of this. But the whole point in doing that is, or the whole point in having a tool like that is so that you don't forget this. So I think having a tool like that, have you created your own, or is there one that you enjoy to use?
Well, I have used several over the years. And I can't say that I have like a favorite, especially now that I'm branching out into like other asset classes.
Yeah.
I don't have like a recommendation, but you know, I certainly have tried a bunch of the different ones that are out there, and they all have, you know, they all have good things and pros and cons. And so,
sure.
At this point, I haven't built my own. And I don't know that I will, but you know, I mean, but I also take a very close look at every model that I'm using, and I try to see, well, what is this telling me? And what is this not telling me?
Sure. You know? Yeah, because every tool, an underwriting tool like that, does tell a story, right? And you can tell it was, most of the time those are written with some sort of philosophy. There's a philosophy in an underwriting tool of where things are placed and what different values are placed on, you know, emphasis on different parts. And you can tell, you know, usually you can tell a tool and say, you can see a lot of heaviness on one specific side of the underwriting. You probably can, they've probably experienced problems in that specific area of underwriting in the past. And so you see a lot of that stuff, but this is why I wanted to have you on, because you are just a wealth of knowledge in the underwriting game. And so, let's transition just a little bit as we, I'm always cognizant of time as we wrap up here. What do you see on more of a, we talk about 20,000 foot view. You've talked with a lot of investors over the years, and you and I have met with passive and active, but on the active side, what do you see as the differentiator from those that are really successful and those that just, they struggle or aren't able to get to the level that they really want?
Yeah, I would say that you have to have grit. You have to have a combination of things. You just have to keep pressing forward. I mean, I think that's like the number one thing. Huge. Is just keep pushing the ball forward and doing something every day to push that ball forward. I think that's like the number one thing. The other thing is you got to have some self-awareness and think like, okay, well, what is it that I could be doing differently? So really building those relationships with people is so important. It's just, this is a team sport, and you know, the more relationships that you have, the more you can talk to people, have substantive conversations with folks, and come from like the same school of thought, you know? So it's been helpful for me to partner with folks who, you know, we've learned from the same people. So I would say those are two things, is like, just like a certain intensity that's required to just keep progressing and taking action and making things happen. I would say that's like the number one thing.
Yeah. I think I think that is a great, great, great point for our people to hear, because real estate is one of those things you can get up. I mean, this week we've been runner up or third place to three deals and lost out on three deals. And that happens, right? Especially right now in the market, you have to, I feel like I have to underwrite and make twice as many offers to get as much action as I did before COVID hit. And but yeah, you're 100% right. That grit is going to bite people, or it's going to help people. That's fantastic. So as we exit, first of all, I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us today. Your knowledge is phenomenal. And I think people that are underwriting are going to see, as they start to dive into the actual underwriting process, are going to see some of these things that we talked about today are gonna come up, and it's gonna help a ton. So as we exit, tell me, just, I always love to ask our guests, what are a couple resources for our listeners? What are a couple books that have had a great impact on you, real estate? They can be real estate, business, or life related books that you just say, you know what, these were really impactful to me.
Yeah, certainly. So I really loved Hunter Thompson's book, Raising Capital for Real Estate.
That's a great book. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so many nuggets in there. And I just learned so much from it about, you know, real estate and how to raise money for real estate. It was just chock full of useful vignettes. So, even if you're not raising capital, it's still really, like, you'll still learn a lot about real estate. So that's one resource. And on the life side, I would say there's a book called Atomic Habits. And that book has, you know, I come back to it a lot with habit stacking and just really trying to, because, you know,
great book.
Yeah, because what we do every day, that's how we are going to be, you know, that really defines how things are going to look. And so having good habits is so important. And, you know, it's always a work in process. I mean, I could always be improving on some of my habits, but it helps to have some strategies. And that book gives you a lot of strategies for building in good habits.
And I believe that's James Clear. Is that correct? I think that's the author of Atomic Habits.
I can't remember, to be honest.
I think it's James Clear, but of course, both these books will be in the show notes. So make sure you go down the show notes. You can click on those. And but again, Suja, thank you so much for your time today. Underwriting is one of those things where I said this to you right before we hit record. A lot of people, it's not as sexy as finding deals and talking to investors, but this is where being able to project and then, of course, fulfill on those projections is where all of the revenue is really made in this game. And so thank you for your time today and your expertise. Your story is fantastic. I still love the part about using student loans. I'm going to tell that story forever.
Definitely. Yeah.
I love it.
And just like one more reminder to your listeners that I really do think for people who just want a free resource on underwriting, that syndication school series on underwriting is really a great place to start. If you can just push through that, practice on a deal, get, you know, a rent roll and a T12 and practice with that, then you'll know more than many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll also put the syndication school, Joe Fairless' stuff in the show notes as well. And thank you for that, because those are some really good tools so people can start practicing. Because underwriting is like that. You go through it 4 or 5 times, 6 times, and then you get a little bit better every single time. And it is truly an acquired skill. Some, especially people that tend to be a little bit more meticulously detail-oriented or numbers people, they probably enjoy the process a little bit more, but it is really good to go through. And so thank you again for today and just giving us your wisdom. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And how can people, if they want to reach out to you, want to know what you're doing, want to know what kind of deals you're working on, what is the best way to connect with you?
Yeah. So, my website it's luxcap.com and that's LUXE-CAP.com. And my email is Sujata@LuxCap. So it'll be in the show notes, but
yes, it will. Yeah. Yes, it will. And so thank you so much, Sujata. I appreciate your time, your expertise, and, I've always appreciated our conversations and your heart for people. So thank you so much and, keep making a difference. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Mike. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Power Up Real Estate Podcast with Mike Fritz. This podcast has been brought to you by Titanium Capital, the home for multifamily real estate investing. You can find them at titaniumcapitalhq.com. That's titaniumcapitalhq.com.